Access number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Rio 6. Now, so after you'd finished at headquarters, what happened there? Which company were you?
Basic training. I was sent off to C Company, commanded by Major Jack Devy, D-E-V-Y, a Canadian who joined the Northamptonshire Regiment during the war and then found himself in the Suffolk Regiment after the war, soldiered on for several years and then vanished from view, left the army.
Now, what was he like as a company commander? Very important, the subaltern's first company commander.
Yes, absolutely right. It was an extraordinary thing. We were driven up. There were three subalterns that travelled out from England, myself and Peter Paxman and John Hex. Peter Paxman, national serviceman, came to C Company with me. John Hex, I think, went to B Company, I don't recall. We arrived with, I don't know, half a dozen fellows that were being posted from our draft to C Company. And somebody at the gate of our little encampment escorted myself and Peter Paxman up to the office where our company commander was, Jack Devy. And Jack Devy was dressed as he almost invariably was in the company base, with his SD cap, peak cap on, and a sarong with nothing else. Had a huge moustache. And he was very light-hearted, very amusing, very effective company commander in such conditions. His soldiers thought very well of him. And
how did he meet you? I mean, what was, you know...
Well, he was... the camp was comprised a row of rubber tappers lines, which were fairly modern, and that was occupied by the company office, and the company commander had his own accommodation in it. The officers of the rest of the company were in a tent just beyond it, and behind it to the back were the tents of the soldiers.
Now, did the small camp have a name,
It was named after the small settlement near which it was, which was a place called Batu Anam.
And how do you spell that?
B-A-T-U, second word, A-N-A-M. That's the Malay for the sixth milestone. Batu being a stone, Anam being six. And milestone six, in other words, yeah. And that was the name of the camp. C Company was in Batu Anam. He interviewed, Jack Devy interviewed Peter Paxman and myself separately to talk to us, to find out, you know, a bit about us, I guess. He first of all complimented me on my excellent singing voice. Because during the 3 weeks, if this is not too much of an aside, during the 3 weeks recruit training at battalion headquarters in Sagama, we had an officer's dinner night when all the officers, except for one or so necessary to remain behind in each of the company detachments, came in, and we all wore tropical mess kit, and the three new subalterns had to perform to entertain the rest of the officers' mess. And for my performance, I sang a song from the Mikado, Gilbert and Sullivan, which was music I enjoyed. And I was, I'd had probably too much to drink, and I think, you know, I made a pretty poor hash of it, but everybody seemed to think it was all right. And Jack Devy congratulated me on it. While he was talking to me, and here is the more serious aspect to life in Malaya, while he was talking to me, he had hardly got out of his mouth the fact that I would be commanding 8th Platoon, which had not had an officer commanding it for some months, but had been commanded by Sergeant Ashdown very effectively, and he would from now onwards be my platoon sergeant. He was at the moment with his section of 8th Platoon out on a jungle patrol. And within minutes of this, we were sitting on the veranda of this rubber tapper line area, he and I together, and a breathless lance corporal from Sergeant Ashdown's section came up on a rubber tapper's bike, fell off the thing. I mean, it's almost sort of American film action, but it was not really, it was serious. He came staggering across, his face was white as a sheet, and he said, "Sir, Sergeant Ashdown has been killed." And Jack Deavy said, "Oh, what happened?" He said, "Well, we bumped a camp, a major, as it turned out, a camp of something like 100 strong, and they rallied a defence against us, and nobody else was wounded, but Sergeant Ashdown, who was at the front of the patrol, was killed outright." So the enemy then, as we fired back, the enemy filtered away and left. And I can't remember the corporal's name now, was left in charge of A, the body, and B, the section, and he made his way out. And Jack Deavy said, "Well, you're going to be dropped in at the hard end, at the deep end, because you better take the number two section, which would be your section when you take over patrolling duties, and go out and bring Sergeant Ashdown's body back." And it was about 4 hours march in, and I can't remember, certainly 6 hours march back. So we sort of spent half the night in the jungle with the dead body, and then we brought him out, by which time the medical people were there to take him off to a morgue, and next thing I knew I was attending his funeral.
It was important to retrieve a corpse in that way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Couldn't, morale-wise, would not allow it to be left. No. I mean, we always retrieved the dead bodies of our enemy and brought them back. That was not for the same reason. That was for identification purposes, of course.
Now, how did, you were obviously going to be babysat by Sergeant Ashdown. That was presumably the plan.
Well,
he would sort of...
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because there's an interesting relationship between a senior, well-respected platoon sergeant and a
sergeant. Oh, yes, absolutely right.
But now
so he was not there.
So what were you going to do? How did you settle in with 8th platoon?
I should say that a new platoon sergeant was produced fairly soon. It was a Sergeant Rees. But also the babysitting was took place. He was a good man also, I should add, but not of the calibre, as everybody suggested to me, not of the calibre. Ashdown was a particularly strong member of the sergeant's mess. But I got Sergeant Rees in his stead, and I worked very well with him.
And how did you work with Rees? Is it Rees, R-E-S-S?
R-E-S. R-E-S. His first name I wouldn't remember. I might be able to find it somewhere, but I don't recall it.
Now, how did you set up a working relationship?
Well, the working relationship... Remember, I described earlier how each platoon was split into two sections, and the sergeant had one for patrolling duties, and the officer had the other. The only time, therefore, you met was in camp. And so you met in camp on administrative arrangements or sports or on the ranges and so on. But given that most of our time was spent patrolling, the likelihood of your being in camp at the same time as Sergeant Rees and his section was fairly remote, in fact.
So was there a corporal in your section?
Oh, there was indeed,
the
yes.
The picture of the straight and narrow? Or,
yes, there
you
was.
You needed it. I mean, you know.
Oh, yes, no, you're absolutely right. And for the first few patrols, which was just, the initial patrols I was sent on were simply general reconnaissance patrols to see what we could find in the area. And I can't remember the name of the man now, sadly, but I had a corporal. And I said to him, before we left, I said, "Look, I want to carry this, I want for this first exercise, for this first operation, I want to be a private soldier. I want you to lead the section. If we have a bump with the enemy, then obviously I will leap forward and take over command of the thing. But for routine movement in the jungle, I will be a private soldier in this first exercise or two, first operation or two, so that I can become accustomed, A, to the soldiers, and B, to the terrain,
Now, can you just explain, it's fairly obvious, but why you did that?
Because I wanted to demonstrate that I was there to learn still. They had most of them, I mean, they were all, virtually all, National Service lads. So some of them had been there anything up to 18 months and were quite clever at operating in the jungle. And I wanted to demonstrate that I was prepared to learn, I think. It was quite interesting because, in fact, on this very first patrol, I learnt that my corporal, whose name I don't recall, was not very good at map reading. And when we were supposedly moving in a straight line, and I noticed that we had recrossed our own tracks, I knew that he was not capable of map reading and using his compass. And so I said, look, let me have a go now. Let me come up the front. And he was delighted. He was not happy about it. So I took over and I went in a straight line as where it was necessary. I mean, I should add that navigation on foot in tropical jungle is a very skillful occupation, very difficult.
Now tell me how you did it. Now let's pick up that topic because it is obviously important to a patrol. How do you tell where you are?
Well, most of Malaya has a central spine of hilly mountains running all the way down the peninsula. When you drop down to the east or the west of that spine, it's all heavy jungle, where, as I said earlier, you usually can't see more than 4 or 5 meters away from you. You then drop down into undulating hills, which eventually fall into swamps or low-lying ground. And when you get closer to the coast on both sides, but specifically on the west coast of Malaya, you move into the territory of rubber estates and so on, which have been, jungle has been cleared. I mean, I should add that even to this day, 4/5 of the peninsula of Malaya is jungle covered, 4/5 of it, and it's the size of the United Kingdom, roughly speaking. So, you know, you understand how the sort of terrain we're operating in. If you can only see 4 or 5 meters in front of you, how do you navigate through the jungle? Well, you've got a map, you've got an inch of the mile map which shows the jungle, and it will usually show the contours. It's very difficult to calculate the distance you've walked. You have to have your compass in your hand the whole time. So you've got your weapon in your right hand and the compass in your left hand, and you're following the compass. You obviously know that if you can follow a stream, and you know that it will have high ground both sides of it, and you can climb up, gradually traverse up onto the high ground. You might, if you were very lucky, you might get from the higher ground a distant view of a recognisable feature in terms of hilly terrain, but very rarely. You plodded on and ploughed your way in a given direction and then changed your direction. I'm wandering on now, but the problem is, of course, what depends on the job you're doing. If you are doing general reconnaissance and trying to locate an enemy in a given piece of jungle area, there are all sorts of tactics that you deploy.
Well, let's look at a typical general reconnaissance patrol and pick up the things. Now, firstly, what briefing would you get before you go on it? Because, I mean, or at what point does the patrol start? You know, because it doesn't start when you go off into the jungle. There must be a preparation phase before. So, I don't know whether you want to pick on a particular one in your mind or just an early one, but you're going off on a general reconnaissance patrol, a section you're leading.
Yep. So, you're given your brief. First of all, the company has a given section of jungle and rubber inside which it is permitted to patrol. And that is its operating area. You know that from police intelligence, you know that in that jungle, there will be some terrorists. At our stage in Malaya, you know that they are likely to be camped somewhere reasonably close to the jungle edge, because they can't live on fresh air, and they must take food and medical support from local settlements outside the jungle. So here you are, you are given an air, your company commander would say, okay, well, I want you to operate between gridline so-and-so and gridline so-and-so on the map, and patrol the edge of the jungle. And you know that the way to do it is not to walk along the actual edge of the jungle. The way to do it is to go into the jungle a mile or so, and then turn right, if you like, and march along the edge of the jungle a mile inside. The reason that you do it that way is that the terrorists are very aware of how careful they have to be in exiting the jungle when they're looking for their administrative support from the local villages, and so they don't exit the jungle all in a great group, leaving a huge track for us to locate on the edge of the jungle. But they can't, on the other hand, walk individually all the way from their camp inside the jungle, so they leave their camp on one track and then split out before they reach the edge of the jungle to get out of it without showing much mark to the security forces. So your aim really is to get into the jungle, follow along the edge of the jungle well inside it, and hope you pick up a track. And if you pick up a track, then you follow it, and you follow it with great caution and hope to come upon a camp. This applied to the vast...
Now, what weapons would your section be carrying? What is, you know, your cheering?
Yeah, our section would have... Normally, the soldiers would have... Most of the section would have a number 5 rifle, which was a cut-down number 4 rifle, the Enfield rifle, cut-down. It was developed for the Burma campaign for jungle warfare. It was short and therefore easier to operate, and it had sufficient velocity and range for jungle conditions. So most of the basic weapon was the number 5 rifle. While I was there, the platoon commander, the section commanders, started off with Sten guns, but then went to the Australian Owen gun, which was a similar machine carbine weapon, but much better than the Sten, a really excellent weapon, the Owen. We had normally...
Why was it better? We might as well follow that up now. Why was the Owen...
Well,
what was it called, the Owen?
The Owen machine carbine, as far as I remember. It was... I mean, we've talked about the faults of the Sten gun, that it would often get blocked, and it would cut your fingers off. The Owen gun didn't often get blocked. The magazine was put on from above, and the empty cartridges were ejected below. And it was a much safer weapon, slightly heavier than the Sten gun, but very good. Had an absolutely adequate range, a good punch compared with the Sten gun, and ideal for jungle operations.
So you have one of them?
Yes. Normally, then, you had 2 Bren guns. Remember, you've got a section of about 15 chaps, 3 groups of 4 or 5. And you have probably 2 Bren guns, one in the rear group and one in the leading group. You were split into 3 groups. You had a recce group, rifle group, and Bren group. The recce group often, as I said, carrying the second Bren gun with it. Made sure that my soldier did not carry the bipod legs of the Bren gun. I also made sure that they were trained to fire this very heavy weapon from the shoulder, in a jungle situation, and not from the hip. There was a great tendency to spray, you know, rather after the American fashion, but aim shots much, much better than from the hip. So you can fix the carrying handle of the Bren gun so that you can use it to hold the gun up, and you could probably rest the gun against a tree if necessary. But you can fire a succession of several bursts using that tree, that gun held from the shoulder. So three. While I was there, the Owen gun was replaced for platoon commanders by the number one or number two carbine, an American weapon, which was very light to carry, and it was a very suitable commander's weapon. It wasn't particularly effective as a firing weapon, although it was adequate, but the great thing for the commander is not to fire his weapon, but to make sure everybody else does. So it was an ideal weapon for the platoon commanders.
Any other weapons with you? Or
Sometimes an EY rifle, the one that fired the 36 grenade or the phosphorus grenade. Not always, but sometimes. Nothing else, I think.
Now, tell me about it. So you went in, did you go in three groups of four to five men.
How did you organise? You travel in single file with the recce group first, the reconnaissance group first, the rifle group second, and the Bren group third. Each of those groups had a commander. I mean, the recce group was commanded by the platoon commander or the platoon sergeant. Normally, you travel, as I said earlier, in single file. Normally, you had a leading scout as the first person of the file, and normally you had the patrol commander, the second person. If sometimes you followed a bandit track, by the way, we called our terrorist enemy bandits in Malaya. Sometimes you followed a bandit track for miles without reaching any sign of enemy activity, where you can only see 4 or 5 metres ahead, and you don't know when the bandit sentry of a camp is going to open fire on you. It's very, very wearing for the leading man, and so very frequently he changed places with the platoon commander. You would keep the leading scout in front of you as much as you could, because the one person that shouldn't be killed in an initial burst of fire is the platoon or the patrol commander. But if necessary, if morale demanded it, then he would go in front.
What would happen? You're going in this formation, groups of three, you know. How far would you pursue these? How far would they go?
What if you bumped an enemy?
No, I mean
over the patrol.
Is it miles we're talking, or what is it?
If the terrain is reasonable, low country but not swamp and not heavy hills, you can move, I suppose, a couple of miles an hour. You could probably cover, in good conditions, maybe 5-6 miles, a bit more maybe, in a day. Remembering that, if there are slight ridge, animals use ridge tracks, because that's the easiest way of getting around in a jungle territory, and they themselves beat down over the centuries, beat down the undergrowth, so that it's very swift movement along ridge tracks. But that's not the place for the patrol to be going, because the bandits would never use it, because they are afraid of you. And you would never use it because you were afraid of the bandits. So you both of you knew that you had to operate in a more cautious manner. So you were operating through virgin jungle, not on ridge tracks. And of course, this took time, because you couldn't, if you take your parangs, as we call them, machetes, they were issued to us. We call them parangs, a Malay word for a knife.
Did you actually use them?
Oh, you used them to clear the undergrowth often, because it was impenetrable in some cases. But you used them as little as possible, because the great thing was to make as little noise as possible as you advanced through the jungle. So you had the conundrum. You didn't want to use the open ridge tracks used by animals, because it was dangerous, but it would have been quiet and speedy. So you chose to use the impenetrable jungle down the sides of the hill slope, where it was slippery and noisy and difficult.
But no one ever thought. I'm just wondering if the terrorists didn't put ambushes on the ridge track, you might have been better off up there.
Oh yes, of course, yes. But I mean, it was the likely place for them to sight if they thought that we were going to move like that. Of course,
you so know. If you'd started sort of doing it at all, they would have all.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
What about communications when you're actually in the jungle? What you'd presume you have a signal with what sort of communication?
Yeah, well, within the patrol, you have a whole series of hand communications. No sound. You don't shout orders in the jungle. You want to keep quiet. So you have a whole series of, you know, ambush left or single file or extended line and so on.
Putting your arms out.
Reverting to single file when the crisis is over and you were wrong and it wasn't an enemy and what so on and so forth. You always, every patrol always had a radio, a wireless set, and a signaller from the signal platoon with it. These were HF radios. They were very difficult conditions. You had to string up a huge aerial, and the only time you would set your radios up was in the evening. Through the night it would therefore be up, and in the morning. In the morning you could communicate usually quite effectively with an HF radio, high frequency as opposed to very high frequency. In the evening, atmospheric conditions crackling out of the earphones made it almost impossible to receive. Anyway, you put the radio up, you strung up your great big SkyWave aerial when you finished patrolling for the day, and it stayed up overnight, and you sent a report the following morning, and then you packed it all in and went on the move. The only other time you would try to communicate was if you had a contact with the enemy at whatever stage of the day. Obviously the signal would immediately get his wireless set into operation.
Now what about so you'd be going out there, what about the bivouac? How would you bivouac overnight? What's the whole process of bivouacking? I mean, what would you sleep on or in?
Well, you would have with you a ground sheet, a poncho ground sheet. While I was there, the 1937 pattern poncho ground sheet cape thing, which we started with, which was very ineffective really in the jungle, were changed to this big square, all enveloping poncho, and two men to one bivouac. So one poncho would be strung up between branches of trees as a shelter, and the second poncho would be laying on the floor to try and keep you dry overnight. In your pack also, as I said, you would have, I mean, if it was a day patrol, you wouldn't have much in the way of food at all, but normally you would go out for 4 or 5 days. So you would have 4 or 5 days' food. You would have a dry shirt and a sweater and a dry pair of socks and a toothbrush. You wouldn't have any shaving kit. You probably wouldn't even have a piece of soap, and you certainly wouldn't have a towel. It was interesting, you put on and a dry pair of trousers. So that as you sat in your bivouac, and the likelihood was that it was going to rain hard during the night, you changed your shirt, you left your shirt outside, you left your trousers outside, you put on your dry shirt and trousers and your dry socks. In the morning, you took your dry things off and put them back in your pack, and you put your sodden cold things back on for the day. And the old army shirt, we all used the old, or the sort of, whatever the shirts are called, not the jungle green cotton ones, but the thick woolly ones that you have had in Northwest Europe conditions, because they didn't feel as cold as a nasty damp cotton thing when you put them on. You wrang the water out and put them on, and there was no problem. And so you slept the night, and if it poured with rain and you were on a hillock, with your parangs, your knives, in other words, your jungle knives, you dug a trench around your thing so that you would deflect the water from running down the hill into your bivouac. And generally speaking, we were all fit young men, and we survived these rather difficult conditions.